Welcome back from lunch. I see that nobody got lost, so that was nice. This session, we're going to have two papers. First is going to be Teaching the History of the Big Society with George Gosling from Oxford Brookes University. And we are going to have a combined set of question and answer time at the end of both papers. So hopefully we'll be able to draw some conclusions between the two different subjects. And I will hand the floor over to you, George.
Okay, thank you. I guess I should start with a quick word first, just to say that about my name, that I'm George Campbell Gosling. You'll see from my badge I'm George Gosling. On the programme I'm George Campbell. If you put the both together, then you get me. So that's something. But I should start really, I guess, with a kind of introductory caveat, really, that I'm not standing here today to speak to you from some huge wealth of many years of teaching experience. This isn't so much something that I've trialled out and I've kind of refined. I'm offering you kind of sort of observations and sort of lessons I've learned. This is very much, as it says here, ideas from the outset. So, with the first of these, to talk about sources. History of the voluntary sector, history of charity and civil society, is something that is very well suited to teaching in history because of the wealth of sources. I don't need to explain to anyone here just how important sources are in teaching history. Of course, they are a wonderful tool. They're absolutely essential in terms of providing a window into a different world. And I think that is something that is absolutely, of course, at the heart of teaching. And the voluntary sector itself, charity groups and campaign groups, have, of course, been very prolific when it comes to providing these sorts of sources. We can take, for example, the idea of written publications. For example, the use of newspapers and these sorts of tools at disseminating ideas and building up a kind of, you know, as a persuasive force for campaign groups. You can go back, for example, to the abolitionists or the temperance movement a bit later. And the use of newspaper-style publications is very prominent there. So there's one type of written source that's very very much available. You can go on also a bit later as we move on to Victorian Edwardian philanthropy in particular, and there are a huge amount of polemics that's sort of written at the time which are available, whether that's sort of books like Self-Help by Samuel Smiles, or whether in a more analytical, more circumspect way, you can move on to the mid-20th century and look at something like the book Voluntary Action that William Beveridge wrote. A lot of people know, of course, that he wrote a wartime report, essentially saying we should have a welfare state. What people are less familiar with is that 5 years later, he produced a book called Voluntary Action, a report kind of surveying the voluntary sector as it existed in the mid-20th century, looking at the strength of it and saying that should absolutely be a kind of second pillar along with extended public provision. And these aren't always so well known about, but these sources are there and are hugely useful if we want to kind of provide textual sources that can be used. But it's not just written sources. We can take, for example, one idea here from the beginning of the movement, the campaign around animal rights. To take one figure, we can see two sources here relating to one historical figure, the MP Richard Martin. Along with people like William Wilberforce, Richard Martin was very influential around the 1820s, really promoting animal rights and promoting the first wave of legislation that really it was brought in for the inspection and the regulation of animal rights and cruel treatment of animals. And in 1822, the first act was passed, the Cruel Treatment of Cattle Act. And the same year, there was a trial, the trial of Bill Burns. And he was a fruit seller. He had a market stall in London, and he had been seen to be cruelly treating his donkey. And he was brought to trial for this. In fact, Richard Martin acted for the prosecution. And when he was seen that this new sort of type of prosecution was not being taken particularly seriously, no one was that interested, he brought the donkey into the courtroom to demonstrate, this is the problem we're dealing with, this is why you should care. And it not only proved successful, because it became the first prosecution for animal cruelty in the world in 1822, but also it proved to be a real sensation. It led at the time not only to this contemporary painting that was done, which now hangs in the headquarters of the RSPCA, but also led to things like this, the music hall ditty. You can see up here, which I won't sing to you, but I, just to give it to you. It says here, if I had a donkey, what wouldn't go? Do you think I'd wallop him? No, no, no. But gentle means I tried, you see, because I hate all cruelty. If all had been like me, in fact, there'd been no occasion for Martin's act. And this was something that was sung popularly at music halls over the early and mid-19th century. So there are various types of sources here, some of them longer, more prosaic, that we can draw upon, and some of them, you know, more visual, able to bring the subject to life a little more. And this is, before we even go on, and I could say more about things like the use of documentary in sort of a persuasive campaigning, or the use of icons and logos, for example. So we have all types of sources which we can use. That's the first one that I would say. And secondly, to move on, I would suggest that there are some very well-established debates, historians and thinkers who've played parts in these debates, and theories that we can turn to. So one we might look at, for example, is the debate around social control, particularly with Victorian philanthropy, the idea coming in here, which we might associate with historians like Alan Kidd, the idea that what we're talking about here is a moral agenda that's being imposed, a middle-class moral code being imposed on the working-class majority by means of the relationship between middle-class givers and philanthropic actors and working-class recipients. And this feeds into a broader debate brought in from anthropology, of course, about the gift relationship, summarised by Fernand Braudel as he who gives dominates. So there's the idea here which we might take, for example, as someone like Alan Kidd versus someone like Frank Prochaska, who would focus more on altruism as explaining charity. And there's a debate there that you can introduce students to. There's another one, again related to Frank Prochaska, about the role of women and the impact on women's lives of philanthropic activity. Frank Prochaska very much suggesting that Victorian philanthropy and the ability to get involved in this liberated women in the 19th century. It allowed them to move from a domestic sphere to a public one. And this is something that was introduced in the 1980s and was seen as being a little bit of an extreme idea and has very much become a kind of accepted view of history at the time. One prominent historian of welfare in modern Britain I was talking to fairly recently, where I said that I wasn't too fond of one of Frank Prochaska's books, and she simply replied, "Well, no, that's because he's awful." Although, to be fair, he was right on women. We've all accepted his view now. So it has very much become an accepted view, although there are debates to be had there. Was philanthropy the only acceptable role for women to enter the public sphere? Were there other activities they could have engaged in? And, of course, when we say women, is this all women, or are we just talking about middle-class women? So there are debates, another debate there that you can have with students. A third one, when we move more into the 20th century, did the rise of the welfare state crowd out civil society? Certainly there's a body of thinking there to suggest that it did. Certainly that would be popular with some politicians at the moment. But then there are, ranks of historians you can bring in, myself included, to kind of counter that suggestion and to look at the ways that civil society and the voluntary sector adapted over the 20th century rather than simply being shut out, may perhaps have quietened down on in terms of the voluntary provision of welfare. But there are other areas there that you can see it stepping into. For example, you can take the wartime expansion of welfare services. But then at the same time, what you had was the creation of something like the Citizens Advice Bureau, which was purposely established to provide information to citizens about these new services that were available to them. So in some ways there, the expansion of the welfare state created a new role to some extent for the voluntary sector. So there's a debate you can have there with students to go on. And to say also it's not just these established historical debates that can be brought in. There are also, for example, various approaches from the social sciences, just to flag up one, the idea of the creation of social capital can be brought in here. So there are new ideas there, but there are also kind of well-established debates, which you could take back to Alexis de Tocqueville or beyond, about whether voluntary association plays a key role in a democratic society. That's a well-established idea relating to the idea of social contract, but then, of course, there have been people who have questioned it. You know, Anthony Crossland is, I think, probably one of the most quoted and cited political figures in the 1950s and 60s. But in the late 1950s, he wrote some sort of saying that actually we didn't need a hugely engaged or active citizenry. He suggested, in fact, that actually a kind of a nation of busybodies constantly on assemblies worrying about the world's ills would actually not be a very positive thing. He suggested instead actually that we only needed around 3% of the population to be those sorts of active citizens. Let the rest of us, he said, cultivate our gardens. So there are debates there which relate, which are ongoing historical debates that can be brought in. So as well as having sort of a body of sources which can be brought into teaching and a kind of established sort of canon of debates which can be kind of used as the focus for teaching, I would say it's also something that we should look at teaching. There's a huge relevance here. I would say there's a relevance to all kinds of historical topics. Just as one example of how teaching might be brought in, you know, an overview of, say, charity and civil society in modern Britain, going back to, for example, the abolitionist movement in the late 18th century. This would engage with some very much key themes in modern British history, modern British social history, perhaps, I should say. And these are some things that I've already talked about, you know, whether it's poverty and welfare, class relations through the idea of social control and the gift relationship, the role of women, did it liberate them, but also how successful was the suffragette movement, you know, how similar or different was the first and second waves of feminist campaigning and civic activity. These things are there, but also we could look, for example, not only at voluntary associations in terms of welfare or in terms of campaigning, but also what we might think of more as cultural associations, ways of people coming together for shared pastimes, perhaps musical or sporting. And these tap into other debates which have very much taken off in recent decades. But it's not just the way Britain works in itself, it's Britain's relationship with the wider world, for example. So imperial networks, whether we're talking about, well, abolitionism would be another one example again, but also missionary society or sort of, as we move into a post-imperial age, the kind of NGOs working around the world. This is something about Britain's, not only Britain's national identity and character, but Britain's place in the world as well. You can then move on, for example, to look at the treatment of minority groups and what places voluntary associations, what that might show us about those groups. And I suppose in a wider sense, when we're talking about social change in many ways, this is a kind of a way into what were those social changes, how did people engage with them or respond to them? And of course, social change raises moral debates. You need to think of, you know, the debate about the permissive society and perhaps, you know, looking at Mary Whitehouse might be a rather colourful way into that debate there. So by looking at the history of charity and civil society, we can tap in to a huge range of debates in wider social history. But of course, we're also tapping into other debates, perhaps more current political debates. But I would say a few things here. I would say, well, for one thing, not sure how new a debate this is. The term big society is, of course, a very recent one, a term coined, by Steve Hilton, one of David Cameron's advisors, media and policy advisor. In that respect, this is a distinctly political thing. But it's actually doing two things at once, the term big society and this agenda around it. It is at once putting forward a policy and government agenda, which you can see, for example, with the fact that public service reform is central in it. But at the same time, it's also a description of a wider social phenomenon, one that is seen in a positive light and wants to be promoted by that political agenda. As I get louder, maybe this is the big society in action, people finding a voice. But but this is a debate that's going on. And even before the term big society was coined, there were workshops and all sorts of activities involving David Cameron, George Osborne, Oliver Letwin, people like this, which were looking at the place of civil society and the way people engage with it, what it meant about citizenship. So I would suggest that the big society isn't simply a political agenda, although that's one aspect to it, but it is also this description of a social phenomenon. Because it's doing two things at once, I think that's often why you get, for example, politicians asked, what is the big society? And their answers tend to begin, the big society is about this, not it is this. And so I think if we can separate the two to some extent, say, if we might want to discuss the political agenda, but we don't need to, you know, sign up to it or support it, we can enter into this debate, I think. I would say two other things about this. One is that this debate isn't new. There may be some aspects of it which may be more innovative or daring, depending on how you want to think of it. I would flag up their ideas around kind of the introduction of cooperative or mutual structures to public service reform. That's something which perhaps is a little different from what's come before. But I would suggest that ever since the, well, or maybe going back further than the Wolfenden Report of 1978, the place of the voluntary sector within governance, within the mixed economy of welfare, welfare pluralism, however we want to think about these things, that has been, there's been a fairly consistent direction of travel, whether it's Margaret Thatcher involving more housing associations in the provision of social housing, although, of course, demutualising building societies at the same time, so perhaps a mixed picture. But there was a more involvement there. Then I would suggest this stepped up a gear when we look at New Labour, the kind of relationship built around partnerships and kind of engaging more actively with the third sector. So when we look honestly at the big society under the coalition government, this is a variation on a theme, but it's not the arrival of a new theme. It's something that's been very much present in British politics for at least the last 30 years. And as such, I think it is, to make my third and final point on this, I think it is something that we should be discussing with students. If you want to understand, for example, modern Britain or modern British politics, this is a key theme, it's a key area of debate. I haven't, as I said, I haven't had many years of teaching experience, but I have been able to do some teaching. And last week, in fact, I introduced this topic as one of the topics in a modern Britain survey course for second year undergraduates. And I started off by asking them who'd heard of the big society. And I'm pleased that most of them had, but also a little surprised that a few of them hadn't. And I think if we're looking at history students becoming history graduates and going out into the world, I think one thing that we would hope they would take away is an awareness of current debates and social issues, political issues, and a kind of historical understanding of what they are, where they came from, and what they're about. And I would suggest that this is an area where we can do that, where we can really engage them and ground in a kind of historical understanding this debate for them. So to summarise, I think, firstly, that the history of charity and civil society is a topic that we can teach. It is one that's there, even if it's not your research specialism. It's a subject which does have, it is, I would suggest, ripe for the teaching, both in terms of the wealth and variety of sources available, but also the sheer number of historical debates that it taps into at the same time. And I would say here, of course, charity and civil society often pop up as topics on the fringe or on the periphery of other major themes, where in fact we can actually flip that on its head, and it's beneficial to do so, to actually make charity and civil society the central theme and engage with other things around it, particularly when it's something that is being debated constantly in politics at this moment. And that political debate, just to summarise what I said there, it is not something that's new. I don't think we should see it solely as something to do with the current government, something that if you talk about, you're signing up to the government's agenda. I don't think that needs to be the case. Of course, that is a fairly sensitive topic at the moment, not least when we've got issues with the AHRC and priorities and funding coming up there. But I don't think that means we should shy away from it. In fact, I think it means, if anything, that we should be grabbing onto it and redefining it ourselves as historians, saying this isn't a new thing. You don't get to decide what it looks like. In fact, actually, if we have this historical discussion, it allows us as historians to have a greater input on that debate. And so really, to finish off, I think that I've been surprised looking at the job market, but looking around at what's going on, just to see how rarely this is a key subject that's addressed and put at the heart of undergraduate history teaching. And in fact, I think we could do a lot more with it. That's really all I have to say. Thank you.